Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Morning. We welcome you all to the first oral argument of what we call the September 2014-June 30, 2015 term of the court, although there are no such terms of the court, because the court sits 12 months a year. The first case is 12AP-2044-CR, State versus Dillard. And Ms. Lloyd, Assistant Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin, will argue for 25 minutes on behalf of the state. Ms. Hines, will Assistant State Public Defender, will argue 30. Can use 30. You don't have to use all the time. But the two of you know that. On behalf of Dillard and Ms. Lloyd, you get 5 minutes in rebuttal. That's a reminder to all of us if we forgot the rules over the summer. Ms. Lloyd, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court. The State is here to ask this Court to reverse the published decision of the Court of Appeals, which found Mr. Dillard had established a manifest injustice warranting plea withdrawal. Despite the Court of Appeals and Mr. Dillard's efforts to fit his case within the well-established framework of what constitutes a manifest injustice, they have greatly expanded the law and have carved out a new area in which a defendant may withdraw his plea after sentencing. In the Court of Appeals and in Mr. Dillard's view, a defendant may withdraw his plea after sentencing, even when he understood the charge to which he pled and the penalty that that charge held, when he is not now facing any consequence that he did not anticipate or was not told was possible, when he admitted to the crime, and when he admits now that his effort to withdraw his plea is based solely on his dissatisfaction with his sentence. This Court has plainly said that what happened here, a mistake in a charge that was dismissed, that the defendant did not ultimately plead to, is not enough to satisfy the manifest injustice standard that a defendant unknowingly entered his plea.
You say the reason for his complaint is the increased sentence, the difference between the 8 years contemplated by the parties and the 40 years imposed by the court. Does he not also complain that he was prejudiced by the ineffective assistance of his counsel?
Yes. I would say that most of what I just said went to the first prong on the unknowing and involuntary test of manifest injustice.
Okay.
And then the second part is whether he has a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel and whether or not he would have pled absent the mistake. And I think, though, that when you look at the whole record under Kane, part of the what we know now is that this is about his sentence, and that then that undermines his claim of prejudice, because had he been sentenced the way he thought, he still would have entered his plea.
Well, I guess I'm interested in the idea of prejudice as it goes to knowing the accurate charges that have been issued against him.
Uh-huh.
And if he was prejudiced, as he asserts, I would like to know your response to that.
Well, our position is that he was not prejudiced.
Why not?
Because we think that given the totality of the record and circumstances, it shows what the circuit court found, that he would have entered his plea regardless of whether it had been accurately pled in the first point. And I think that, though, this goes to what the state is arguing, is that this is really a better fit for an ineffective assistance of counsel claim than it is for the manifest injustice test under an unknowing plea.
And as part of the plea process in front of the circuit court, the bargain for matter, the bargain for portions of the complaint, the two charges were dismissed.
The state does does not condone the mistake that was made here, but believes simply that it's just not necessary to expand the law in the way that we believe the Court of Appeals has done in its decision. As Justice Gableman said, the remedy to a perceived wrong in a case like this, we think, fits under ineffective assistance, or he probably has a strong claim, I would think, that he is entitled to resentencing based on a new factor when the court at sentencing clearly still thought that he had been originally subject to this persistent repeater. So to allow him the extreme remedy of plea withdrawal at this time, when the current law doesn't support it and other remedies are available, is unnecessary.
Counsel, are you familiar with the recent decision of Pigeon versus Judy Smith from Judge Crabb in the Western District that came out on the 29th of August?
I've skimmed it, yes.
Okay. And that focuses on a case much like this case, but just focuses on the ineffective assistance of counsel. And in that case, Judge Crabb found that it was below the standard acceptable for counsel, and that the performance was deficient, and that it was prejudicial. And as I recall, let me take a look so I have it right, the writ of habeas corpus was granted, and that, and allowed for the plea withdrawal.
Yes, and I think that without going to whether the state police, Judge Crabb's ultimate ruling was correct, I do think that that's how this case fits. I think this case is an ineffective assistance case, not an unknowing plea case. So I agree with that framework, that that should be what we look at. Mm-hmm. As far as the prejudice in that case, my understanding is that it wasn't a Mockner hearing since it was held in federal court, but the hearing that Judge Crabb held didn't have testimony from Mr. Pigeon's attorney. So we don't have all of the record that we have in Pigeon that we have in this case, where we have counsel saying, I still would have recommended this, and I still think he would have taken it. Now, of course, on the other hand, we have Mr. Dillard saying, no, I wouldn't have. But the circuit court is assessing this credibility and also looking at this totality of the record, which includes the fact that he wouldn't have been upset if his sentence had been the same. So it seems hard to say that he would have pled even if his sentence had been the same. I'm looking at the whole thing, I don't think that he has established prejudice. And my reading of the Court of Appeals decision didn't say that he'd established prejudice either. It said, basically, we don't know. Well, it's his burden to show a reasonable probability that he would have proceeded to trial had he understood the persistent repeater didn't apply to him. And our position is that he just simply didn't meet his burden on that.
Is that a question of fact or law? You seem to argue in your brief that it's a question of fact, and yet I've always understood that it is a question of law. The historical fact of what actually happened is something that we give deference to, but how the historical fact applies to the legal standard is a de novo review.
Absolutely, and I apologize if my brief was misleading on that. I do understand that it's a question of constitutional fact, and that there's the credibility determinations. What would counsel have said, and was that believable, and what she would have recommended, was that believable, and whether what defendant is saying at the hearing, is that credible, and whether or not all of that adds up to prejudice is the ultimate legal conclusion.
And the ultimate is what a jury, that is the fact finder, would think about it all, not what the appellate court thinks. So the issue isn't whether I don't think, and I think Justice Crooks wrote on this before, that whether appellate court thinks that believes the defendant when he said, hey, I might not have done this if I had known all of this, is really not the issue, because it's plausible, and isn't that for the test is what a jury, would there be reasonable probability that a jury would be persuaded.
Well, this is a case of withdrawing a plea, though, so we're not dealing with the jury, correct?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Can you conceive of a situation where a jury would decide that?
I'm not familiar with a jury deciding prejudice on an ineffective assistance.
No, but the test for prejudice is what a probability of a jury would do, isn't it?
I thought it was just the reasonable probability that he would have pled or whether he would have gone to trial as determined by the fact finder, which would be the court.
That's right. That's right. Okay. Now, I have a problem on several things. One, manifest injustice has several scenarios that fit manifest injustice. One is knowingly, intelligently, and understanding the plea, right? And this case falls under that aspect of manifest injustice.
That's Mr. Dillard's claim, yeah.
And then it goes back to Bangert and Bentley and Brown. And there was a hearing on this, right?
There was a hearing on this.
That's right. And the trial court found that it was knowing, intelligently, and understanding done, but that's a question of law, right?
Yes.
Okay. And the concept of whether it was knowing, intelligently, and understanding is related to the concept here of ineffective assistance of counsel, isn't it?
I think they're related, sure.
Yeah, because the ineffective assistance of counsel charge is that the defendant was misinformed, right?
Correct.
By defense counsel, by prosecutor, and by the court.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, didn't knowing and intelligently and understand it that.
Yes, I think they're tied together.
So they are related. And I looked at page 24 of your brief, and you say in the first paragraph, thus, the comparison is between a sentence of life imprisonment versus a sentence of a maximum of 50 years of confinement for a 51-year-old man. Is that sentence correct?
That is not correct, and I have it circled in my brief, and I apologize for that. It was pointed out to me this week. I meant imprisonment, not confinement.
That's right. Your terms here of confinement,
yes,
imprisonment, which includes confinement and extended supervision. And so what I'm trying, the point I make is as late as an appellate brief, there's still confusion here about what his potential sentencing would be. The other issue is, and I think you make this in this case, is that he is charged with two offenses. The plea agreement drops one, right? But continues the repeater.
No,
doesn't continue the repeater, right? Okay. Well, the repeater should never have been in as a matter of law, right?
Correct.
So how do you plead when you plead to an offense and a repeater? You don't have two pleas, one to the offense and one to the repeater, do you?
No, I think I understand that you plead as a repeater, but I would say that that's two different charges. One is armed robbery. One is armed robbery as a repeater.
Well, that I agree with. And a big issue here is whether you pled, what offense did you plead to?
Mm-hmm.
And so one charge is gone, and he doesn't ultimately plead to that. But the other charge is still there, even though the repeater is omitted.
I would disagree with that characterization,
okay,
because I think that to anyone, mostly to defendants, a charge of armed robbery and a charge of armed robbery as a persistent repeater are two different charges. So he did not plead to the charge of armed robbery as a persistent repeater. I don't think it makes a difference under the Denk analysis or any analysis, really, that it's an enhancer as opposed to a different charge. The effect is the same. There was a difference in exposure that was large, and there are two different charges.
But can there really be, there's no independent charge as a repeater. I mean, the charge is the substantive charge, not the enhancement.
But if I were to accept...
I say that in argument. I mean, that's always been my understanding.
But see, the problem that I have with that, then, is that the reverse is, let's say he was charged with some form of homicide, as well as armed robbery as a repeater, and he was told it's not a mandatory life, it's something less, say it's some sort of reckless homicide, and he's charged with something as a persistent repeater. So he thinks he's facing life without parole. But you drop the charge of the persistent repeater, and he pleads to the other.
Well, look.
It makes no difference to him.
Look, if you want to use that kind of analysis, let's say they have a charge of just the allegation of persistent repeater as an the enhancement under the statute, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they have the armed robbery. If they drop armed robbery, is there left an independent charge under the statute for an enhancement, which I am quickly but not so effectively finding?
93962?
Say that again.
93962?
Yes, that's right. I mean, that doesn't contemplate an independent substantive charge, 93962-2M, isn't at all. So your analysis of it's an independent charge.
No, I don't think it's an independent charge. I think armed robbery as a persistent repeater is an independent charge from armed robbery. And I think any defendant facing that would understand that to be it's an entirely different charge. It has incredibly different penalties and a different element that the state has to prove. I think that those are two different charges.
Could you clarify exactly, if the law had been accurately applied, what the maximum sentence would have been on the two felonies charged?
I think, though it's a slightly different, difficult question to answer, given, as opposing counsel points out, since everybody got it wrong, we don't really know what the original charges would have been, because I suspect he probably would have been charged with some sort of repeater, just not a persistent repeater. But if you take out the persistent repeater and just look at the complaint as armed robbery and false imprisonment as a repeater, it would be a maximum of 50 years imprisonment, and I think that breaks down to 32 years initial confinement and 18 years of extended supervision.
But he had a felony conviction in 2007.
Yes, I think that he could have been charged as the,
could have been charged.
93962-1C, which I think would have exposed him to an additional 6 years.
Okay. And he could have received a consecutive sentence, consecutive to the sentence he was serving when he was convicted.
Yes. And I think he was sentenced to consecutive to the revocation term.
I thought it was concurrent.
You may be right. I don't remember. I thought it...
They'd asked to be able to argue for a consecutive sentence, but
right.
I think the court imposed a concurrent sentence.
Okay, I accept that. Yes, the point is that he was facing a substantial amount of time, and I understand that life without extended supervision possibility is the most extreme sentence that we have, but he still was facing a lot of prison time.
Is that the state's position? Because he's facing a long term, 32 years initial confinement, and if it's consecutive, even longer than that, maybe, that it makes really little difference whether it's initial 32 years of maximum time or more, and it makes little difference whether life without parole.
No, I would say our position is that he pled knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently when he knew what he was what he was pleading to as well as the penalties he faced, and he didn't get anything different than what he was told he may get. And then the number of years faced, I think, goes to the prejudice and underscores the circuit court's finding that, or conclusion, that he would still have pled, because an 8-year recommendation from the state was a significant benefit to him, given how much he faced.
You paused just now, and I want to revisit that question. You said the circuit court's finding or the circuit court's conclusion. I thought that at the beginning of oral argument, I understood it to be a de novo review. In your brief, you advanced that the circuit court made, it looked to me like you were arguing, a finding that he would still have pled guilty absent the threat of a penalty enhancer. My research indicates that in the constitutional fact realm, that that is a de novo, it's a matter of law, that this is not the kind of historical finding, when did it happen, who was there sort of stuff, that we give deference to. I just want to clarify that, because your answer just now, finding conclusion, right. Again, melds that.
I think that all of the credibility determinations, as I said, what counsel, whether the circuit court believed that counsel would have made this recommendation, whether the circuit court believed Mr. Dillard when he said he would have gone to trial, those kind of findings are factual in nature. Whether those factual findings add up to a showing of prejudice is, I think, the ultimate legal conclusion that this court reviews de novo.
I have several cases, because I looked at your brief and it just was, I wasn't sure, and you were both arguing different positions on that. And it seems to me, and I look at a Pitch case, P-I-T-S-C-H, I don't know, I think 85, and there's another one in 99 that I looked at, and it would seem to me that it's not the kind of historical fact that we give deference to. This is what would have or could have happened. Historical fact is what did happen. Can I get your response to that?
That's interesting. Yeah, I still think when you're dealing with prejudice, we aren't dealing with what happened in a case like this, because we're dealing with something that was speculative.
Prejudice is, of course, determined as a matter of law. We deal with that, whether or not there was prejudice is
a
matter of
law. I don't disagree with that. I just still think that there are credibility findings to be made. I mean, if counsel wasn't credible, if the court didn't believe that she would have made this recommendation, I think the court's allowed to disregard that. And I think that that's just a classic credibility determination. I completely agree, though, whether or not those things add up to a showing of prejudice is a matter of law. If there's any other question, I'll just reserve
yes,
my time.
Right? I thought I heard you said that Mr. Dillard would have a strong claim for resentencing.
I think this read to me as a new factor case, given that what he's upset about is his sentence, and that the circuit court and all the parties misunderstood this factor that was relevant to sentencing. I would think that this would fit under the new factor law.
Is that part of this case now?
No, he has not argued that. I think he may.
Is this court in a position to do anything about that?
Well, I think this court can craft nearly any remedy it probably sees fit. So I think so. I think it would be possible to remand it for resentencing.
Remand it for resentencing?
I mean, I think you can do nearly. I don't see why that wouldn't be available.
Let's assume that we want to follow established law. Let's start with that assumption. What would your answer be on that?
Well, I would say he hasn't raised it, so it's not before the court.
Fair enough.
established law generally is, though, that any kind of forfeiture with regard to that is administrative, and that, as you said, the court can craft any remedy as it sees fit. I think. Tell me if you...
I don't have any authority to tell you that you can't do something like that. Whether you should or not, it's a different matter, and we'd say that you shouldn't since it's not before the court.
He's asking for withdrawal of the plea, if I understand it.
He wants to withdraw his plea.
It was a case that raised the issue of that's the remedy or sentencing the remedy, but I have frankly forgotten what the court said.
Yeah, okay. I should look.
And now you say, on page 26 of your brief, you say, the Court of Appeals seemingly placed the burden on the state to prove lack of prejudice. Is your reference to paragraph 20 when, is that where the Court of Appeals did the burden?
I think also paragraph 20, sort of in the middle after the footnote 5, the state's arguments that this mistake was not prejudicial are unconvincing. I think that when the court said in paragraph 21 that he may have taken the plea offer, but we just don't know, isn't the right standard to say that Mr. Dillard needed to establish a reasonable probability that he would have gone to trial.
In order to find prejudice, the Court of Appeals was required to find that but for counsel's alleged error, Dillard would have insisted on proceeding to trial. And that's page 27 of your brief. And no such finding was made here or can be made here because the totality of the circumstances demonstrated Dillard would have accepted the plea even if he never faced it. Now, what's the state's argument on that, that he would have accepted it? One, that because of the other act's evidence, right?
The other act's evidence.
And two, hey, not so much difference between the agreement and what would have been the actual sentence.
Well, no, I disagree, because the actual sentence he could have been facing up to 50 years, and the state's recommendation of 8, I think, was...
Oh, but that was... in this, but the court never had to take the state's recommendation.
No, I understand, but I think that that's a pretty good benefit to a defendant who's facing up to 50 years or 32 years of initial confinement.
No, it wasn't that much year of initial confinement. Didn't we agree it was less?
It, as the original charges would have gone, it would have been, well, it would have been 50, right? So, yeah, 25 and 32.
Imprisonment would have been 50.
Right, 32 years of initial confinement.
Yeah, that's different.
Initial confinement. I know. I'm sorry. I thought I said 32 years of initial confinement.
Good.
Yes.
All right. That is if he pled to the complaint as charged with no plea agreement.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Right. Okay. Without the mistaken enhancer. Mm-hmm. Correct.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Hines, representing the defendant, Mr. Dillard, and Assistant State Public Defender. Counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Donna Hintz, and I represent Myron Dillard, the defendant appellant in this case. We're here today asking this court to affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals, which found that Mr. Dillard established a manifest injustice for plea withdrawal in two ways. First, that his plea was not knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily entered because he was misinformed from the beginning through the end of the case of the penalty that he faced for persistent repeater. The armed robbery is a persistent repeater. Secondly, the court found that he was denied the effective assistance of counsel when his trial attorney failed to recognize due diligence and determine that, in fact, he could never qualify for being a persistent repeater and therefore never ever faced the most serious penalty that Wisconsin has of life in prison without the possibility of extended supervision. That's a mandatory sentence which must be imposed, and the trial judge would have absolutely no discretion if he was found guilty of that. Based on this, the Court of Appeals concluded that because he was so misinformed and he believed that the only way to avoid facing that penalty if he was convicted was to enter into the plea agreement which the state offered, which was to dismiss the persistent repeater from the armed robbery charge and to dismiss the false imprisonment charge, which was the second charge, as a repeater. If he pled to the armed robbery, he would no longer be facing life in prison without the possibility of parole. And Mr. Dillard testified at the post-conviction hearing that that is what the major incentive was for him. That was his primary concern, that he needed to have a possibility of being released from prison someday.
Counsel, you know, it seems to me that we've got two of the primary cases that are discussed by the parties are Dank and, to a certain extent, Cross, and they deal with different stages of the plea hearing. Dank deals with whether the defendant received the benefit of the bargain, as opposed to, I think, the four cases you have cited where the promise that the prosecutor made in regard to the plea negotiation was turned out to be illusory because of a legal impossibility or some other unanticipated cause frustrating the intent of the parties. So we have those line of cases, the illusory promise cases. We have Dank. Did Mr. Dank receive the benefit of his bargain? And then we have Cross, where at the time of sentencing, Cross was misinformed as to the potential maximum exposure. So I think it's very important that we not conflate Cross with Dank.
I agree.
Good. So let's talk about the Dank factors.
Right. And you're going to... not a Cross case.
Well, I think you cited Cross.
I did cite Cross, but I didn't say that this case should be controlled by Cross. Cross is a situation in which...
Yeah, I know what it was because we authored the opinion in our chambers, but my question is this. Because this situation seems to fall outside of any of the previously established. I know you're going to argue it doesn't, because you're going to say armed robbery as a persistent repeater is the same as armed robbery in terms as applied to the Dank test. What is the rule? What is the rule that you would like to have emerge from this case to be applied to future subsequent cases where the charging document alleges something that is simply, that cannot be proven because the charge cannot as a matter of law be proven. However, the defendant pleads according to the plea agreement and gets the benefit of his bargain, if we're looking at this literally, which I think we should. So what rule? How do we harmonize these into a cogent rule?
I don't think you need to fashion a new rule. I think that the rule we have in Dank and the rule that was followed essentially in the four cases that we've cited, Rakoff, Brown, Dawson, and Woods, all apply in this situation.
Those were cases, weren't they, counsel? And I'd like you to address this, where the promise turned out to be illusory.
The promise in this case was illusory. The promise in this case was that the penalty that he faced for armed robbery as a persistent repeater would be reduced, that he would no longer face the persistent repeater
without parole. Tell me what part of the bargain that Mr. Dillard entered into, tell me what part he did not receive.
The part he did not receive is a reduction in the penalty that he faced. He believed when he entered
his plea. No, he faced, that charge was dismissed.
The charge was not dismissed. The charge is armed robbery. The penalty enhancer for armed robbery was dismissed.
Okay, so the penalty enhancer was dismissed. He received that, so he's no longer facing that. He enters into a plea agreement. What part did he not receive?
His understanding was that he faced a maximum sentence of life without parole if convicted of the armed robbery charge with the persistent repeater enhancement. He was told that if he entered his plea to armed robbery, he would only be facing 40 years of imprisonment, of which 25 years could be initial confinement. The problem here is that he was never explained that when he entered his plea to armed robbery, he was facing the same penalty with the plea that he faced without the plea, had he gone to trial, because the persistent repeater penalty enhancer was illegal and could not apply to him. So the misunderstanding here, the basic misconception that permeated this entire case, is that he could have been sentenced, if convicted of armed robbery as a persistent repeater, of life without parole, and that wasn't possible. So he thought he was getting a major benefit of eliminating the possibility of being confined for the remainder of his life if he was found guilty of the armed robbery. That simply didn't occur. It was an illusory promise because the state could not bargain away the persistent repeater, which didn't apply to him.
So you're saying it fits within the four cases you discussed earlier, you alluded to earlier.
Absolutely.
Because rather than the sentence, in those four cases, each of the illusory promises, I think, had something to do with the sentence. This was illusory because whether the state dropped the penalty enhancer or not, he was facing the same consequence.
Exactly. And that is something he did not understand.
Okay.
Nobody understood that.
I hear you. And I take your point. But my question is, Those four cases dealt with basically a post-conviction process which revealed that the benefit was illusory. Dank talks about a defendant who receives the benefit of his bargain, the dismissed charge, the plea, the understanding of what he potentially faced. It seems to me that procedurally, this fact pattern is somewhere, it doesn't fall procedurally within either of these. So should it be that if the complaint, should the rule that emerges from this case, in your opinion, be that if the complaint charges an incorrect charge that could not be established, and that charge is dismissed, then what? I mean, that's what I'm struggling with here. Procedurally, what would the rule be that accounts for the facts of this case and yet can be applied to subsequent similar ones?
I think where we may have don't have a meeting of the minds is I read the four cases that you're talking about to say, yes, there was a future bargain that couldn't be fulfilled.
Right.
But those cases never said that that's the only circumstance in which there could be a manifest injustice and that your plea could be unknowing and involuntary. And in fact, when the manifest injustice test was first established in Reppin, which adopted ABA standards, it was not the exclusive list. And so what I'm suggesting is that whether or not the illusory bargain is in the future that can't be fulfilled or whether it takes place at the sentencing, it doesn't matter. So long as there is an illusory promise that cannot be fulfilled, that legally is impossible to be fulfilled, that the defendant should be permitted to withdraw his plea.
You see, I don't know that a criminal complaint constitutes a promise.
The complaint did not make the promise. It was the plea bargain that made the promise. The bargain between the district attorney and the defendant, that if he entered the plea to the armed robbery alone, the persistent repeater would be dismissed. Part of the problem that I have with the state's case is that they're asking for a change in the law. Although the state cites Kane for looking to the totality of the circumstances or all the circumstances surrounding a plea to determine whether it's knowing, intelligent, and voluntary, what they're actually asking this court to do is have a tunnel vision and only look at the offense that the defendant pleads to on the date of the plea. And don't look at anything else surrounding why he's entering that plea. But that's contrary to what this court has always said. This court has said in Bangert that a trial judge has to inquire of the defendant whether there are any promises that have been made to him to elicit this plea. You've also said...
And then they usually follow that up 6 years as a circuit court, other than the plea agreement itself.
Yes, but you also, this court also said in State X Row Gray, White versus Gray, that the plea agreement should be stated on the record. It's not mandatory, but it was a recommendation that that be done so everybody knows what the playing field is that we're dealing with, so that the court can ensure that the defendant's plea is knowing, intelligent, and voluntary.
I think you're, one point that I agree with you on wholeheartedly is you're right. We don't have a meeting on the minds that it fits within the string of illusory promises cases, because if you stand on that, it seems to me the state can equally stand on Dank and say, a bargain was made, the defendant, Mr. Dillard, received the benefit of his bargain, the charge was dismissed, the circuit court fulfilled all of its obligations by reciting all of the potential results, all of the rights that Mr. Dillard was giving up by entering into the plea. And so I guess I see the need for some kind of bridge here to reconcile the facts of this case with those two.
Counsel, I'm trying to figure out a rule, too, because your case is very important to you and to all of us, but what we say will be important to a lot of other people. And what Justice Gableman proposed to you was, should the rule be that if the complaint alleges a court a charge that could not be established, what then? And what I hear you saying is, what then is no plea following is valid as long as that misunderstanding is there. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Is it the complaint? Maybe I misunderstood the question.
I'm just reading back what Justice Gableman asked and trying to get her to finish the sentence for me.
Complaint document, information, yes.
Based on Justice Gableman's scenario here, we have a mistake in the complaint.
Yes.
And what he's saying is that...
My scenario is we have a mistake in the complaint, right?
We do.
All right.
A gross mistake in the complaint. And if that is carried throughout the case, then I am saying yes, then no plea to any charges that would involve dismissing that or otherwise reducing that or any kind of a plea in relation to that would not be valid because the defendant doesn't understand that there's been this major mistake. This was so pervasive through the entire case that it affected the charge, obviously. It affected perhaps the plea negotiations because we have no idea what the state would have done had they actually known what the correct penalty was, that he did not that he could not be a persistent repeater. Had they known that, we don't know what the state would have done. We don't know what the plea offer would have done. We don't know what the defendant would have done if he would have entered a plea, because we simply don't know what the circumstances would have been. So, yes, if there's a mistake in the pleading stage that carries throughout the plea proceedings, then the rule should be that any plea that is entered as a result can be withdrawn because it's not knowing, intelligent, and voluntary.
Do you really have to go that far?
No, I don't think you have to, but I think you could establish that rule. I think that Dank...
Aren't you really arguing that he was somewhat induced into entering this plea because he thought he was avoiding the possibility of life?
Absolutely.
And instead he was capping it at 40 and he was getting a recommendation from the state for 8?
Yes.
Isn't that really what you're saying, instead of just saying you can never enter a plea if there's a mistake in a complaint?
A mistake in the complaint that carries throughout the plea stage. Because we don't know what the effect of that mistake in the complaint is on the entire proceeding. But I agree that you don't have to go that far.
Then that almost changes. I'm just trying to suggest to you that it seems now to me like you're trying to change the manifest injustice standard, where the defendant has to prove by clear and convincing evidence, right?
All the defendant would have to prove would be, well, look at these proceedings, and this mistake occurred all along, and therefore there's no possible way anyone could ever enter a plea. And I'm just sort of bringing that to your attention because I think you're going further down that line than you really intend to, or at least that I got from your briefs and your arguments previously. And maybe I'm missing the ball. But one of my questions, and I'm just going to get it out before you're gone with someone else for a while. At the withdrawal, or at the request for withdrawal, the post-conviction request, he basically said, didn't he, if I want to receive this maximum sentence, I wouldn't be bringing this motion. Does that have any impact on your argument at all?
None. It's totally irrelevant. Because the defendant can't, any defendant may have grounds to appeal, but may decide that it's not in his best interest to do so. In this case, if Mr. Dillard had indicated that if he had received either a 5 or an 8-year sentence, he probably wouldn't appeal. Because to do so, once again, exposes him to a much greater penalty, and he cannot know what the outcome of a trial would be. So it wouldn't be in his best interest, he felt, to appeal if he'd gotten a lesser sentence. That doesn't mean that there's no merit to his claim. It only means that he, under those circumstances, would have exercised his freedom of choice not to appeal, not to move to withdraw his plea.
You got to button that up for me a little bit, though, because to me it's a little different to say, and I get it that defendants don't always appeal everything that they could. I mean, particularly if they get a better deal than they thought they were going to get here. He ended up with a tougher sentence than even the state recommended. But I understand that, but I'm trying to ask you, how is it that he can prove manifest injustice under the standard that he has to meet when he says, hey, if I would have gotten a different sentence, I wouldn't be bringing this claim?
Manifest injustice doesn't have anything to do with the decision of whether or not to withdraw your plea. It has to do with fundamental fairness. The manifest injustice standard is met if a defendant can establish that there are basic questions that affect the fundamental integrity of the plea. And that's what we're saying occurred here because of the gross mistake that was made that was carried through throughout this case.
But what he's really saying is if I entered a plea and the court sentenced me to 5 or 8 years, because he was recommending 5, right, and the state was recommending 8, he's saying I wouldn't be bringing this motion, it would be fine. But because I got a tougher sentence, I'm bringing the motion. And that has no impact on the standard?
Okay. The manifest injustice standard is a legal standard. And whether or not he has satisfied that standard has nothing to do with whether or not he would have been satisfied with a different sentence. The legal standard is whether or not he entered his plea in a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary way, or whether he was denied the effective assistance of counsel. If either of those standards are met, then the manifest injustice standard is met regardless of what plea he received. If he received a sentence of probation...
Regardless of what sentence he received.
I'm sorry. Regardless of the sentence that he received. Even if he received a probationary sentence, he would still have met the manifest injustice standard if his plea wasn't knowing, intelligent, and voluntary, or if he was denied the effective assistance of counsel, both of which the Court of Appeals found in this case.
Well, manifest injustice is an umbrella word that includes several categories that have been defined in the cases and might include other categories.
Exactly. Right? That's exactly what this Court said when it adopted the standard in State versus Ruffin.
Okay. And in this case, manifest injustice, the umbrella, the emphasis is on KIV, that is knowing, intelligent, and voluntary, or a general concept of fairness and integrity.
Yes.
Okay. Which includes ineffective assistance of counsel, which raises the question of prejudice, right?
Yes.
All right. I'm going to go back to what Justice Gableman asked you, but I'm going to phrase it differently, which is, how would you write this opinion? You've got Cross, which says if there's a de minimis problem in what the defendant is told about the sentence, it's not going to be manifest injustice. It's not going to be give, right? And it's not going to be ineffective assistance of counsel.
That's what Cross says.
That's Cross.
But Cross is a situation where the error is made at the plea.
This does not quite fit the factual basis of Cross, right?
Correct.
Okay. It got Taylor, right? Which also was an, quote, error in stating what the sentencing was. And he pleads, right?
Yes.
And Taylor, too, says not every error in explaining the sentence is going to kick out the plea, right? And this is not quite a Taylor factual situation. So as I see the case, which may or may not be true, or may not be persuasive to other members of the court, this doesn't quite fit the factual situations we've already had regarding errors made by prosecutor, defense counsel, and the court on sentencing. Is that correct?
I agree with that.
I know you do. Okay. So, under this fact situation, we got a repeater, which is one charge, and let's just take the armed robbery, and the issue of how you plead to a repeater charge in the state. What is the rule that this court should say? Give me the fact situation that covers this, and what is the rule that comes out of this case? In your opinion, and I'll ask the state the same thing.
You could craft a rule in its very narrowest form that is a takeoff on Cross and Taylor. It's a takeoff because the fact situations are different. A takeoff would be that if the defendant is advised that he faces a penalty, which is substantially more than what he actually faces as a matter of law, then if he enters a plea based on that misunderstanding, he should be permitted to withdraw.
Okay, and here the point would be he thinks he's facing life imprisonment without parole, and he's facing 50 years of, I have to be careful, imprisonment with therefore less confinement and extended supervision.
Yes. And what I think is the important part of this and what almost any criminal defendant would tell you is that the significant portion of that sentence of imprisonment is the confinement portion. So the comparison that the defendant really was looking at here in practical terms is spending the remainder of his life in prison or a maximum of 25 years in prison. Actually, it would be 32 because of the
25 plus the second offense.
The second count. And with the opportunity to argue for less.
So the difference between 32 and life matters to this defendant, even though he's 50.
It matters to a defendant because at that point, when you're looking at the difference between life and 32 years, why not go to trial, frankly? And also, I think it's significant that if you have a sentence of life without parole, you have no hope.
You have to repeat what you just said for me because it seemed to almost undermine everything you were saying. I took your argument as there's a big difference between 32 years and life, and therefore that would have been reason enough for him not to enter a plea. But in the next breath, you said, look, when there's 32 years or life, there's really no difference, so you might as well roll the dice and go to trial. So
what the state has done is thrown in, and the trial judge has suggested that this defendant is 50 years old, so if he's going to get up to 32 years, it's a life sentence for him anyhow.
So you're saying for him it's life or life. So he might as well go to trial. Why do you ever enter a plea no matter what? Other than the state's recommendation of 8 years instead of 25.
Which
he got. He got them to recommend that.
Yes, but he's also told by the judge that the judge need not follow that. And under these circumstances, he certainly had reason to believe that the judge might not. But the important part is, I think what the Court of Appeals was saying is that the possibility of being able to be released from prison at some point in time is a hope that any defendant would want to have. It gives you a reason to live from day to day. And that hope is taken away if it's a mandatory sentence of life without parole. So he has to weigh that. And a 32-year sentence or life without parole, he has to decide which is better for him. And 32 years for him might be life. So if that's
the matter. To me, you're arguing against yourself. You were going so good. Now all of a sudden you're back. I'm hearing the opposite from you.
Well, I think both of these are considerations that the defendant has to take into account. He has to decide for himself. And I cannot speak for Mr. Dillard in terms of what his thought process would be. But there certainly is a huge difference between never being released from prison and the possibility at some point in time of being released. And he has to decide at that point, what does he do? Does he risk going to trial and not being sentenced to prison at all because the case, as he believes it, is weak? But if the jury doesn't agree with him, then he's spending the rest of his life in prison.
You know, counsel, I think there's an important part of the case that I'm not confident you've had the opportunity to discuss, and I don't know if you want to discuss it. But it served as the basis of a colloquy between the Chief Justice and your opposing counsel at the commencement of the state's argument, and that is the trial court's findings. How, if at all, in your estimation, and what I'm referring to specifically, and you're probably aware of it, is where the trial court said that there were several reasons that Dillard into the plea. The penalty enhancer was one reason, but, quote, that the other acts evidence of the almost identical type crime taking place with a sexual assault, and that evidence coming in on this case would have been devastating to any type of defense in this case. How, if at all, in your estimation, should we deal with that?
There's a part of those that are findings of fact, and there's a part of those that are conclusions of law or constitutional facts. What Mr. Dillard was told prior to the entry of his plea are historical facts. He was told by his attorney that there's the possibility that other acts evidence would come in. He was told by his attorney that if he entered the plea, he would avoid life without parole. He was told by his attorney other things. Those are historical facts, what he was told. The conclusion of the trial court's conclusion of what the defendant would have done if he had had the correct information is a constitutional fact which is reviewed de novo. The court can only know what the historical facts are, what was said, what was done. Those are findings of fact by the trial judge. What a defendant would have done is something that has to be reviewed independently because that's the fundamental constitutional fact that has to be determined by this court.
Thank you.
How do you get the 32 years, please?
He was facing two counts, the armed robbery and the false imprisonment. The armed robbery is a maximum term of imprisonment of 50 years, of which 25 years could be initial confinement. He was also charged with false imprisonment as a repeater, which carries a sentence of imprisonment of up to 10 years, of which 7 years could be initial confinement. So that's how it would be 32 years on the entire charges. We were comparing before simply the armed robbery with and without the persistent repeater enhancement.
Okay. But isn't it true that the defendant committed a felony within 5 years of this particular offense, the armed robbery?
That is true, and that is why the false imprisonment was charged as a standard repeater, based on that 2007 conviction.
If it's charged as a repeater on the false imprisonment, are you unable to charge it on the other offense?
No. The state could have chosen to charge him as a standard repeater on the armed robbery also, which would have added on 6 years, which would have increased the full penalty from 40 years to 46 years, which would have increased the initial confinement period to 31 years, with then 15 years of extended supervision.
Oh, wait, let me try this once more. Can you charge the repeater on both offenses?
Yes.
Okay. Isn't that more than 31 years?
If they're consecutive. If they're...
It becomes 31 years of initial confinement and 15 years of extended supervision for a total of 56 years.
It would have added
46 years. I was right to start with.
It would have added 6 years to the armed robbery.
Yes.
For confinement. And it would have added how many years to the second count on confinement?
He was already charged as a repeater on the second
okay.
count.
So that was already in. So it would have added 6 more years, but it would have not been life without parole.
It would not have been life without parole.
Your point. But it wasn't charged that way.
It was not charged that way.
I think I'm getting 25 plus another,
six confinement.
Six.
For the armed robbery, if he was charged as a repeater.
Okay. And then seven.
And then seven from the false imprisonment as a repeater.
All right. And the possibility of consecutive sentence.
Well, that would be making it consecutive.
Consecutive to what he was serving.
Yes. Okay. I misunderstood.
Well, 38 years for someone who's 51 years old, or 50 years old, that's pretty close to life in prison.
That's if he received the maximum. He did not have to receive the maximum. He was free under the plea offer to argue for less.
Oh, okay, but that's sort of what was at stake here. One is sort of theoretical, life in prison without parole, and the other one is 38 years, but potentially that 38 years doesn't start immediately.
As it was charged in this case, it was a difference between life imprisonment and 32 years of initial confinement. Because he was not charged as a standard repeater on the armed robbery. He could have been, but he wasn't.
No, because they charge more.
Which is what he wanted to avoid. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hines. Ms. Lloyd? Ms. Lloyd, what is the rule? How would you write the opinion in this case?
We're not asking for a new rule here. We think this fits squarely within Denk. The charge at issue was what he understood he would be charged or what he would be pleading to. So we think that he failed the unknowing test of Denk. And then under Bentley, our position is that he hasn't shown prejudice.
Okay. The point under Denk's deals with, is he pleading to the same charge or to a different charge? Isn't that your point?
What I heard the defendant say is that regardless of what he pleads to, if there's a mistake in the complaint, it doesn't matter. So this whole emphasis on enhancer versus charge seems to go away, which makes sense to me because it seems like it doesn't matter. It's just what you're exposed to. And if Denk says that that doesn't matter, then it shouldn't matter what you've, as long as you've pled to a charge that you understand that's consistent.
Counsel, isn't it paradigm
for analysis is, in a plea withdrawal, you have to show that post-sentencing, that there is a manifest injustice. One of the ways to show a manifest injustice is whether is to inquire whether the plea fulfilled the requirement of being knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. And if it wasn't that, then you get into a category of manifest injustice. And the point at in time at which you do this analysis, whether the plea is knowing, intelligent, and voluntary, isn't when the complaint is filed, isn't at the time of sentencing. The point in time of reference is when the plea is entered. Is the plea entered when it's knowingly entered, voluntarily, intelligently entered, and voluntarily entered? Am I not pointing to the correct moment in time to determine if it's, we call it KIV, if it's KIV at the time the plea is entered? Isn't that the focus?
You call it KIV? Is that what you said?
Knowing, intelligent, voluntary.
I like that. That saves a lot of time.
I know. That's an intelligent, knowing way to do it.
I would say that that is where you start, but according to Cain, you still look at the whole record to determine whether at this point, whether it would be a manifest injustice to allow withdrawal, because things afterwards might have changed.
My question in part responds to this, what's in the complaint when it's filed, how that has kind of seeped into this argument. I didn't really understand the defense to say that was the irrelevant point of inquiry, because I think defense was responding to a question and then said, and if it permeates the rest of the proceeding.
True.
I took that to mean, I didn't sharpen the response because I just let it go, but I took that to mean, including at the time when the plea was actually entered, that permeation stuff, because that's the initial focus of our inquiry into whether a plea, when entered, is KIV.
But under that standard, if the court's going to say something like that, then if the defendant had pled to false imprisonment as opposed to armed robbery, he still would get relief because his position is it's permeated the whole proceeding. So it shouldn't matter whether it's an enhancer or a charge.
In this case, and I look to, in part, the testimony at the hearing post-sentencing, but also the letter sent by the defense attorney that communicated the plea. And as I read that letter, with the emphasis and capitalization and underlining and just the space given to the issue of, hey, look what you're getting. You're getting that there is no life without parole in this deal. On the second page of the letter, it is in one paragraph, further you're getting, you know, that the victim is a credible witness, it appears, and the possibility of other acts evidence coming in. But, boy, the focal point seems to be, at least in that letter, what you're getting is relief from the life without parole. Do you agree with that or disagree?
I agree that that letter certainly emphasizes the absence of the life without parole in the plea agreement. But I think the point is that there were other things as well. And under Denk, it's not just this illusory benefit, which the state doesn't think that there was an illusory benefit here. He got the benefit of the bargain. But one of the other things that Denk looks at is whether he now faces some unintended consequence that he sought to avoid. And there's nothing that he points to that he now has faced that he was seeking to avoid. There's no sex offender registry. There's no consecutive sentence versus juvenile sentence. There's nothing different about this case. So if this court is going to fashion a new remedy under the unknowing standard, then we would ask that you limit it to something this serious as a life without parole situation. Because if you had, say, a misdemeanor charged and the enhancer was incorrect And then this would just open up all sorts of plea withdrawals that I wouldn't think that anyone would intend. But it seems that these enhancers are sometimes mistaken. They get tricky in terms of numbers of years and when the conviction was final and when the case was brought and whatnot. And so if you're going to say that any time an enhancer that permeated the record, that the defendant didn't want to face 2 years and wanted to face, you know, a recommendation of 30 days in jail instead, I think that just goes way too far.
On the second issue, do you concede deficient performance?
Yes.
So the issue is only prejudice?
Yes.
Okay, and the deficient performance is that the counsel didn't know what the law was, right?
Yes, I think that all parties should have probably understood that this was not, there was one charge, I mean, there was one conviction that should have set everybody on notice that this didn't fall within the persistent repeater.
What was the basis in the sentencing of the court giving the maximum sentence?
Well, I think that the court did still misunderstand that he had been at one point subject to this persistent repeater, which he hadn't. I think that that is part of the court's remarks.
I'm sorry. Repeat that.
I think that at sentencing, the court still thought that the defendant had gotten this larger bargain than he really got, that the court still thought he had at one point been subject to life without extended supervision.
I thought that the sentencing transcript indicated that the court thought that he was a repeater, even though he under the law, was not.
He was a repeater. He wasn't a persistent repeater. But yes.
Sorry.
Right. No, I'm sorry. I thought that's what I said. I think that the court did continue to misunderstand his status.
Court.
Yes.
And sentenced court. Him on the basis of him being a persistent repeater, even though he was not.
Well, I think it sentenced him based on his criminal history and the availability of the sentence that was available to him. But it certainly... He certainly misunderstood that charge wasn't appropriate in the first
place.
The
trial court misunderstood.
The trial court, right.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument in State of Wisconsin versus Dillard, and I want to thank both counsel for briefs and discussion of a fact situation. In this case, it's not quite like the ones we had before. The court will take a brief recess before it calls the second case for oral argument.